Hello and welcome to Story Radio, the podcast for readers, writers and lovers of literature everywhere. Today we're delighted to be speaking to Lottie Mogak about her new novel Mrs. Piercy, which has just been published by Phoenix Books. Lottie Mogak is the author of three previous novels, Kiss Me First, Under the Sun and Brixton Hill. She grew up in Camden Town and now lives in a slightly quieter bit of North London with her husband, son and dog, which is where we're interviewing her today. Welcome to Story Radio, Lottie.
Delightful to be here.
Can you tell our listeners a bit more about your novel and the inspiration for it?
Yes, so Mrs. Piercy is based on the story of the eponymous Mary Piercy, who was a notorious Victorian murderer. She was convicted of killing her lover's wife and child, a young child, in particularly sort of shocking way. She killed them in her kitchen and then put the bodies in the baby's pram and wheeled them through the streets of North London to then dump them a few miles away. And so this case really caught people's imaginations, not only because obviously it was an unusual and shocking murder, but because she was female, which is very unusual in itself. And this was also a couple of years after Jack the Ripper, so the papers were very hungry for a new, juicy, gruesome story, and this really fitted the bill. So at the time, it was a huge press sensation.
I was very intrigued to learn that you had a link to Mrs. Piercy's story through your childhood home. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, of course. So although it was, as I say, it was a massive story at the time, in fact, there was a display at Madame Tussauds after Mrs. Piercy was executed, which drew 30,000 people to come and see this one exhibit, which just gives you an indication of what a huge story it was at the time. She's slightly faded from notoriety for, because I think she was, for several quite interesting reasons, which I won't go into now. But anyway, it wasn't, she's not in the canon, I would say, of Victorian murders now, like Crippen or obviously Jack the Ripper, but so it would have been possible I wouldn't have heard of her, except that my granny lived in the house where she reportedly committed these murders, so it happened in my granny's kitchen.
Wow.
And so I grew up with this story and feeling, yes, and so it was sort of our family horror story, really.
When did you discover that?
So I discovered it when I was about 8, when we moved into the house opposite my granny's house in Camden Town. And that's when I heard this story. Interestingly, actually, I bumped into a couple the other night who are completely adamant that happened in their house. I think everyone they lost competing claims. But my granny heard about it through a journalist who knocked on her door when she was when she had just moved in and asked her how she felt about living in this house. And she hadn't heard of Mary Piercy either, so it was a shock to her too. So I'm going to my granny's house, but yes, this other couple were very adamant. But the houses, the street has been renamed and the houses have been renumbered since, because it was such a horrific crime. So that's why it's slightly difficult to pinpoint the actual house. But like I say, I'm going to go with my granny.
You can see why they would, want to renumber the house, yes, and rename the street. Yes, because yes, it was. I'd never heard of her before reading your novel, but it was obviously quite shocking.
Are the relics still in Madame Tussauds?
Ah, yeah, good question. So the pram is, and that's actually still on display in the Chamber of Horrors. There's one tiny cabinet which still has the relics, which Madame Tussauds once, that was their stock in trade. They would go and buy up these objects associated with true crime. So now they're slightly downplaying that side of their past, I think. And they're going for more for the sort of more wholesome side of, selfies with your favourite actor kind of thing. But yeah, there's still one cabinet and the pram is in there beside Dennis Nielsen's TV. It's hidden away. But all the other things that, because they bought everything that was in the kitchen where it happened, so all the utensils and even the piano she was playing, and I mean really they just seem to have bought up her entire flat and all those things. I don't know what's happened to them. I did email Madame Tussauds to ask, and they just they said the archive was closed. They weren't, they couldn't help me at all.
This is better than Dennis Nielsen's waste disposal unit, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
What was it like researching a historical novel as opposed to a contemporary one? Because your other novels are contemporary, aren't they?
Yes. I love research, and I could have just... I mean, the problem with is just stopping the research and realising you actually have to write, because I could read... I love Victorian novels anyway, and so it just was an excuse to read lots of George Gissing and Dickens, although he was a bit earlier than what I'm writing about now. But so, yeah, I loved all that. The problem is just realising, you know, how much you shouldn't put in, which I think is what every historical fiction writer has to contend with. You know, you've got to really kill your darlings when it comes to that, because otherwise you can just you can forget about the story because you're so enamored with your all the details that you've picked up on the way that you can't bear not to include them all. The newspaper archive was massively useful because Mrs. Piercy's story really is told entirely through the newspaper articles. The official like the Old Bailey has official, it has some transcripts, but they're very hard to read, and because the law was, I mean, it seems massive for her, you know, her trial was 2 days long and she didn't even get a say in it, so she wasn't allowed to speak. So in fact the actual transcript isn't that illuminating. It was just lots of evidence that had been told before. So the newspapers were the main source for this story.
Were there any areas that you couldn't find records of that you were really kind of wanting to find?
Yeah, that's another really good question. Yeah, what I really missed, actually, I really wanted a definitive account. I mean, you could pick up from reading all the newspaper things, because it was such a huge story. A lot was written about it, but you sort of realise after reading them that you actually can't really trust them, because there's no regulation of the press, and you could feel that if they would just make things up, you know, they'd try and vaguely get to the truth, but if they couldn't, then they were very happy to just invent a witness who had seen her, you know, wringing her hands in despair, whatever, because it fitted with their narrative. So I wish there was a really, you know, a sort of very solid uncontrovertible like piece of account of the whole thing. That's what I really missed, because like I said, just the feeling that everything was slightly amorphous. The truth was, their casual relationship with the truth. That's my impression after reading all these newspaper reports.
I love the character of Hannah Teal, who's the heroine, the young woman who becomes fascinated by the case of Mrs. Piercy and starts investigating it by herself. Were you inspired by the Victorian New Woman, women who seemed modern and shocking to writers like Thomas Hardy? I know they came a tiny bit later, but presumably they were already in the air.
Yes, well, no, exactly. And that's what I really wanted to write about. That sort of period, that decade seems so fascinating, because it's just, as you say, that things were about to change. The New Woman was, you know, could be glimpsed in the British Library and in Bloomsbury. But I was very curious about what the average woman on the street, who wasn't sort of part of a sort of pioneering intellectual set, what she would be feeling, and whether she would be thinking her life was going to be exactly the same as her mother and her grandmother's, or whether she would sense that things were about to change. So I was really interested in the whole New Woman phenomenon. You're right, it was going to kick in properly a few years later, but I was in... So Hannah, my heroine, she isn't a renegade, and I was very keen to not make her a pioneer. I wanted, like I say, to her to just be really reflective of the average person, but she I wanted her to, through this story, to do something outside of the domestic sphere. She's forced into, or she puts herself in, was placed in a situation where she does have to use her mind and sort of enter the male world of work, and she finds out that she quite enjoys it and she's quite good at it. So rather than her starting off as being sure she wanted to like smash the system, she sort of comes into it through the sort of a side entrance, sort of almost by mistake, and she likes it. But it's very much, I definitely had the New Woman is definitely there as a sort of invisible presence in the book, even though Hannah, I think, isn't quite one yet.
I liked your use of extracts from the girl's own weekly magazine to head the chapters. Did you use them all verbatim, or did you kind of tweak any of them?
No, they're all verbatim. There was so much. The Girls' Own Paper was a fantastic resource. And that's what I mean about wanting. I could have just spent many months just reading that.
Yeah, there was something just about kind of adverts and things which, you know, just give you a mood, don't they?
Yeah, totally. And make you realise what people's preoccupations were. And especially, you know, for women who this was, you know, who were meant to think of not much else apart from what they're going to have for dinner or cook for their husbands or, you know, the new stockings they were going to make. You know, their lives were sort of composed of these really tiny little details, which these magazines are just sort of dedicated to. So, yeah, I really found them fascinating. But you're right, they also had this sort of overarching message about a woman's role in society, which is... And it's those kind of instructions that I start each chapter with, because they're really, again, there is some interesting as the tiny little details about you know gloves, how to clean your gloves or whatever, all that stuff which writers love because it's the colour. But these the messaging given to young women at the time was also really interesting because it was quite persuasive. You know, it wasn't just that you're going to be second class citizens and you're going to be really have a life that's boring and
of endless toil.
Endless toil. Mm. It was much more. You know, they did a good job on making it sound like, you know, if you had enough imagination and sensitivity, then it, you know, the whole, you could find the whole world inside the inside the house.
You say endless toil, but it's funny because like. When Hannah wants a newspaper and she's got her servant who's got to work your way doing the meal, and then the servant starts to go out to the street to get the newspaper for her, it's like, Hannah can't do it. That seems strange. Your characters use a non-contemporary vocabulary, but it's kind of quite understandable. So it's kind of a bit of a hybrid, isn't it? How did you approach constructing a kind of language for the novel, particularly the dialogue?
I really wanted it to feel, not feel like a pastiche of a Victorian novel. And also because as I was writing it, it really felt, it wasn't very long ago, 130 years. I got that sense from the start. When you get a bit older, like when you're younger, you know, it feels like another world, but now it really doesn't. And it feels sort of within touching distance, I feel like. The end of the 19th century. So I wanted to really emphasize the closeness in our, you know, in terms of sort of lifespans. In answer to your question, I started writing as if it was a contemporary story, and then when it sounded too contemporary, I tweaked it. But that, I started from there rather than trying to make it sound like a book written at that time. I wanted it to feel, I wanted to try and close the gap between now and 1890. So in fact, lots of my redrafting was trying to make it sound less contemporary, so less contractions. And, you know, maybe it was tiny little details actually, but I don't use that much old antiquated vocabulary. I made a real effort not to.
You used one great word.
Oh yes.
So drunk or hungover?
Betwattled.
That was it. Yeah. Betwattled. Betwattled.
Yeah, no, there are a few, but things you could, there's so many fantastic Victorian slang words that you could, you know, it's tempting to just fling them about just because they're really great, but I really didn't want to go down that route just because it's very hard to sustain. I think Francis Buffett, also, you know, some people can do it really well, but...
Yeah, I really like his stuff. I think he
is a fantastic writer.
Hannah sometimes questions herself about the ethics of her role investigating and writing about the case, about the murder. Do you share those feelings as an author? Should we question ourselves writing about true crime, for example?
Yeah, such a good question. Yes, I did. And I was very, from the start, I knew I didn't want to focus on the actual murders because they were really... Yeah, I think like women getting mutilated, I know with writing, I'm sure you two will agree, you've got to feel that you're adding something to the world. And I think just writing a sort of rather prurient account of a completely senseless murder of a woman and child wouldn't be doing that. So I personally didn't focus on the murders. And I wanted to examine the sort of true crime industry, I suppose, which you could say started then, and to see it at a distance. By not focusing on murders was my way of...
And by filtering everything through Hannah.
And filtering all through her. I didn't want to, inhabit her, Mrs. Piercy. She was very, you know, a very disturbed person and mentally ill. And I didn't want to sort of try and I don't want to make her unsympathetic. I didn't want to put ascribe motive to her, which may not have been there. I don't think there wasn't, you know, I think it was, she was, like I said, I think she was extremely ill. So I didn't want to sort of, I don't know, do anything which would sound like I'm sort of glorifying her or putting her in the centre of things.
Yeah, no, I think Hannah's got an interesting sort of perspective towards her. She often feels quite a lot of empathy, but at the same time is really kind of, you know, repelled by the crime, but also fascinated by, I suppose, discovering the truth. So it's quite interesting, all the different motivations that she has.
And I sort of hope that's what people, you know, everyone's so, well, there's a certain large amount of people who are so obsessed with true crime now, and I feel like that's sort of, I wanted her to sort of represent how maybe modern day readers feel about true crime, because I think anyone, you know, I like it, but I do feel slightly queasy, and I wanted to sort of,
I have the same sort of ambivalent feelings. Yeah. But there are so many true crime podcasts. So nowadays, Hannah would be a podcaster, I expect.
Rival to you. You dispatch Hannah's fiancé, Cosmo, off to a mental asylum. It kind of reminded me of with children's fiction, young adult fiction, where the first thing is you've got to get rid of the adults. And, yeah, I kind of like the moment where Hannah gets a plea from him to help in his release, and she kind of ignores it. Were there any contemporary sources that served as an inspiration for his kind of voluntary entry into?
Yes, there was. So Cosmo, yeah, you're right. That moment, it is a bit, when I first did it, my agent said it's slightly mechanical, like, you know, it's clearly a plot device. You've got to get him out of the picture somehow, because she wouldn't have embarked on this, she wouldn't have got involved in the case if he had been around, because he was a journalist and that was his job, and so she would not dare, you know, to think of sort of stepping into his shoes at the beginning of the book. So I did have to get rid of him, but what he did, which is to go undercover in a asylum to try and expose the conditions, that was all the rage then, this kind of stunt journalism, investigative reporting. There were lots of young middle-class men doing that sort of thing then. And in fact, in America, there was a craze of young women doing it. And a writer called Nellie Bly wrote a book called 10 Days in an Asylum, which was a huge hit in America. And so he is unwittingly copying her. Actually, he doesn't realise it until it's pointed out to him that someone has done this before, and a woman. That's what he's doing. It's a slightly cliche. Yeah, it's sort of, even by then, at that point, it was seen as slightly cringy, cringy journalism.
Yeah. It was the Rosenhan experiment in the 70s.
What's that?
Stanford did, it's known as a thud experiment, where 12 students from Stanford got themselves interred. They just all described the same symptom, which was that they had the auditory hallucination of a thud. They all got very different diagnoses, and some of them proved very hard to get them out.
Oh, really?
Some of them were kind of stuck in for a long time, even though they said it was this experiment. I mean, they wouldn't release them.
Oh my God, how fascinating! I hadn't heard of that. I'm going to go and look it up.
Yeah, Stanford. They loved it. They loved to go to psychiatric.
I mean, obviously, I know about the most famous one, but I didn't know about that one. Oh, fascinating!
I liked some. There's an interesting aspect of the tension that comes around from the difference in value between sort of contemporary and historical fiction, and that applies both to money and human interactions. Like, you know, with money, we kind of find out how much a penny can buy you in those days, and we're not sure when Hannah gets the money for her story, but she's being ripped off, we suspect she is. But yeah, 5 shillings doesn't seem like a lot of money. But there's also her contract towards the end with Cosmo, that they're going to have this marriage where she doesn't want to have children, at least for a significant period. And I was kind of interested in what she was proposing and how he interpreted what she was proposing. Was it a sexless marriage, because, you know, contraception was not widely available then, and it's obviously something that you can just resolve in the fiction, or you can leave it as a tension. So I was just interested to what your thoughts were in there.
So you're right, it is left a bit opaque. I mean, I think that she was earlier in the book, I talk about how her and her friends sort of get the sex education for what it's worth from, you know, their parents' books. And there are these very sort of obliquely phrased books which tell you about, which try and prepare women for this terrible thing that's about to befall them. Right, it's I suppose I was imagining that in that book there is something which is a very delicately phrased explanation of how you can avoid pregnancy through sex. So I'm imagining she's not proposing a sexless relationship, but she knows that somehow, even if she doesn't know the details, that there is a way that you can actually have sex and try and avoid pregnancy. So that's what I was imagining. But you're right, I didn't spell it out just because people didn't spell things out in those days. And so I suppose I was reflecting that slight coyness.
Yeah. I quite like that, to be kind of just left with the reader to kind of
listen to it. Good. Yeah, I like a bit of ambiguity and not wrapping things up.
And you discuss the boundaries between fact and fiction in your author's note. What were the rules you set yourself? Were you either tempted to kind of give more definitive answers towards the end of what the events were of the crime? Mm.
So the story, the Mrs. Piercy story, as it is, I was quite unsatisfactory, I felt. And I think that's partly why it's not well remembered today, in that she never confessed or explained. He was, you know, the motive was, the only possible motive could be sexual jealousy, but it wasn't really, you know, he was her lover was a horrible man by all accounts. He was really unattractive and charmless, and so people couldn't understand why she would be so moved to such violent passions for him. So like compared to Dr. Crippen, I don't know if you know the Crippen, if you're familiar with the Crippen story, but I think there people could grasp onto the motive much more easily, because the way certainly it was painted was that he was married to this terrible, vulgar music hall star, you know, and she was hard drinking. And of course he wanted to be rid of her, to be with his demure mistress. And people could understand that. And so it's sort of lodged in people's imaginations. But with this, it didn't, because no one could understand why she was so enthralled to Frank Hogg. Yeah, and I because I think she was a fantasist as well, you couldn't really believe anything she said. Anyway, it was a sort of unsatisfactory story, I felt. And so I wanted to make it slightly more satisfactory. And so I did provide some of the answers which were left that real life didn't provide. Obviously, as it's fiction, I didn't feel, you know, I presume everyone knows that it's, you know, that I'm making them up. And I did try and sort of be clear in the author's note that I was embellishing or filling in the gaps. I think because she didn't give any answers herself, I sort of didn't feel that obligation to the truth that maybe I would have, if she had explained things more herself. I think the fact that she just didn't speak at all, she let everyone else just have their own interpretations. The papers thought that what they wanted about her. She didn't correct anyone in real life in her lifetime. So I didn't feel. Yeah, a sense of obligation to the truth, which I think I would have if it was sort of more documented, and if she had sort of directed the story more herself. But she just seemed to just do this terrible thing and then just left it up to everyone just to interpret it and decide what they thought of it.
As I was reading it, I thought you might have made up the advert in the Spanish newspaper.
That's true. Yeah, so there's she left one of her last acts on earth was to tell her lawyer to put an advert in a Spanish newspaper, this mysterious advert which said that she said have not betrayed, and no one knew who this was addressed to, and obviously it got everyone talking, and so that's one of the, and it's never been resolved what this message meant, and I suspect it was just another one of her fantasies. But I did want to answer that. Like that felt like something which I could provide, you know, imaginatively provide an answer for, and I didn't feel any guilt about that because I think, you know, again, I think she'd sort of thrown it out in the world to settle, you know, to get people talking and for people to speculate on. So I was just another person speculating on it. But you're right. I think, you know, it's, I mean, you know, compared to writers where they're writing about far more important historical events, I think maybe you've got more of an obligation to either, you know, to be very clear about what you've added to it. But in this case, because like I say, it was such a sort of mess, I didn't feel that I had to really spell it out so much.
Hannah often compares herself to her more conventional childhood friend, Emily, who's completely content or appears to be completely content with marriage and children, and also to less conventional women like the young actress Dolly. But she ends up choosing marriage to her slightly uninspiring fiancé, Cosmo. Did you ever think of a different ending for her?
Good question. Yes, I did. And in my first draft, she decided not to get married. But that was before I had... Well, maybe not my first draft, but my first thought was that was be her ending. But then as I read, as I did my research, and as I was saying earlier, I found the messaging was very persuasive, I thought, not only, you know, for women to the benefits of marriage for women, and also realizing that women just weren't equipped to go out and earn money. The thought that it must be extremely daunting, the thought of having to go and earn your money when you haven't been taught how to do that, or feel you've got any skills to offer. And so I really wanted her to not be a pioneer. I wanted her to, and I thought that's, you know, you're right, her fiance, he's a bit of an idiot, but he's loves her and he's willing to not pressurize her to have children until she wants to. And that seems okay. You know, it feels like that's like something she can sort of work with, and she's going to have a bit of freedom. And I think for her to choose to, you know, to just go on her own path wouldn't, it just wasn't the character. It just wasn't what I was going for with her character. I just wanted her to
have conventional aspirations, but also be quite adventurous within those confines.
I suppose conventional, but I think to not be conventional was a massively. I think that's what I realised when I was researching it. You must have been really brave to say, you know, you've had this whole century behind you of this being drummed into you that this is your place in the world, in the home, and this is out there for the men. And just to sort of jettison that, I think was an act of massive, you know, you had to be, either you'd have to be brought up in a very bohemian or, you know, where you're encouraged
like
to...
Like Mary Shelley, someone like that. Exactly. I'm trying to work out where she... My dates are terrible. I'm just trying to think where Mary Shelley fits in this time scheme.
1820-ish.
Yeah. She's much earlier.
Much earlier, yes.
I mean, she's much earlier. But, you know, even feminist writers at the time, they weren't, you know, it was just very, marriage was just so integral to life. I just thought having to, what actually sort of stops you from doing things is having children. Let's face it. But actually marriage to someone who, you know, he might not particularly adore it, but who seems happy, you know, in order to have you, he will accommodate the fact that you want to perhaps do something with your life. That seemed to me an arrangement which most women would probably take, in opposed to just taking that huge step of just saying you're going to try and earn your own money and support yourself when you haven't been given any tools to do so.
Or an education, role models really.
That's my long
story. Dolly seems to have quite a good time there, doesn't she?
Yeah, she she does. But she was just, you're right, she does. But, you know, she seems like a difference of breed. Dolly is an actress, as we mentioned. And actually, the bit I'm going to read is all about Dolly, because I do
fantastic.
Like her.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, let's have the reading now.
So this chapter comes from about three quarters of the way through the book. Hannah is now fully engrossed in her mission to find out the truth about the Mrs. Piercy case. And she's very sure that Frank Hogg, the horrible lover of Mary Piercy, has something to do with it. And so she wants to honey trap him to try and get a confession. But she wants some help with this because she's, you know, it's a very bold and reckless thing to do. So she enlists the help of an actress she has met called Dolly, who seems very up for this jaunt. And this is a scene where they're going to the pub where Frank Hogg is known to drink in order to just accidentally meet him and try and elicit confession. She had arranged to meet Dolly at Kentish Town Station and walked to the public house from there. The location of Frank Hogg's workplace had been published in the papers, He helped out his brother Edwin's furniture moving business on Castle Road, which was just off Prince of Wales Road. "We simply go over there," Dolly had said, "and find the nearest place." Hannah arrived at the station with 10 minutes to spare and stood at the side of the entrance to wait for Dolly. It was dark and the pavement was thick with pedestrians, commuters heading homewards and shoppers heading out, sliding around each other like eels in a tank. Noisy supplicants, beggars and sellers did their best to impede them. Beyond them, packed, swaying omnibuses passed by, alongside cart horses trudging with their necks low. Down Kentish Town Road, the banks of glowing shops stretched out of sight, a necklace of lights. It was a drizzly, blustery evening, the kind you didn't want to spend waiting on a pavement. A train's worth of passengers were disgorged from the station, and she straightened up, expecting Dolly, but by the time they had thinned out, she hadn't materialised. Maybe she wouldn't turn up. This was, after all, a mad idea, agreed upon by two near strangers after drinking too much champagne. How long should she wait? A stray seagull was perched on a nearby lamppost, keeping a keen eye on an old man selling sausage rolls from a basket below. The Costa had his own call, saucy, 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 delivered in a seamless monotone, as if the word had been worn down and smoothed by decades of continuous use. As always, the aroma of warm pastry made Hannah's stomach turn over. But now, she had the quiet, stunning realisation that she was free to just buy one. And so, without further thought, she did, walking over and paying a penny to the taciturn Costa, who placed the warm, greasy slab straight into her palm. She moved away to eat it, close to the station wall, turning her back to the crowd. She may now be someone who bought a sausage roll on the street, but she wasn't ready to publicly devour it. Face inches from the oxblood bricks of the station wall, she took a bite and another. Oh, the rare, pure joy of satisfying her greed. "Lining your stomach," came a female voice from behind her. "Very wise." Swallowing, Hannah turned to find that Dolly had appeared at her shoulder. Behind her was a small audience, a handful of male passers-by who were staring at her. She was dressed to be given a second glance, done up like a pantomime dame, her blonde hair piled high and frizzy, a tiny ornamental hat perched on top, then those baby panda eyes and small pink lips. Hannah and the other women around them were dressed for the dreary weather, interchangeable in their dark outdoor coats. Dolly was wearing a tight Ashrakhan jacket with a fur collar over a full red skirt and high boots. A large brooch in the shape of a bunch of grapes, the grapes made from pearls, was pinned to her breast and she was carrying a carpet bag. "A sausage roll," said Dolly. "I want one of those." Hannah pointed out the seller at the entrance, flattered that Dolly would want something she had. Spotting the Costa, Dolly clapped her hands. "Of course, Jackie!" She skipped over and Hannah watched as she greeted him with a slap on the shoulder, his grumpy old face softening at the sight of her. The two of them talked for a minute, the exchange ending with the Costa handing her the roll and holding up his hand theatrically to refuse payment, even though, Hannah noted, Dolly hadn't even made an attempt to produce a penny. "You know him?" Hannah asked superfluously when Dolly returned to her, already tearing into the pastry. "I do," said Dolly, her mouth full. "Had a stint playing at the Bedford, and some of my friends work around here." She stopped eating and threw the remaining half on the ground. The seagull promptly swooped on it. Then she tucked her arm through Hannah's. "Should we go and get the bastard then?" she said. As they set off, Hannah thought she detected the pressure of Dolly wiping her fingers on her coat sleeve, but she wasn't sure. They headed down towards Prince of Wales Road, turning heads and attracting hisses, Hannah feeling like a dowager chaperone as the actress clip-clopped along the pavement. "I can't quite place the public house nearest Castle Road," said Dolly, "but I'm sure I've been in it. I think I've been in them all." "What?" said Hannah. "Every public house in Camden Town? And Kentish Town?" The wind had picked up. Above their heads, shop signs creaked and stray sheets of newspaper and wisps of hay scurried along the pavement. The pedestrians around them hunkered down in their coats. Dolly used her spare hand to keep her absurd hat in place and drew herself tighter to Hannah. Hannah hadn't been clung to like this for a long time, not since the intense friendships of school. As the carriages and hansoms rattled past, she had the vision of her old friend Emily in the back of one of them, mewling red baby on her lap, heading home from a dull tea with her mother-in-law, glancing out of the window and spotting Hannah arm in arm with her exotic new pal. "Oh, Em," she imagined herself saying in response to Emily's hurt, "I'll always be so fond of you, but people change and lives diverge, don't they? It's only natural." Yes, she's an actress, but she's not what you think. Actually, Dolly was pretty much exactly how Hannah had imagined an actress to be, with her glamour and insouciance, her whiff of wantonness. Now, as they continued down the road, she was giving Hannah a guide to the public houses of her neighbourhood. "So, you have the castle," she said. "Edinburgh Castle, Dublin Castle, Pembroke Castle and Windsor Castle. Scottish, Irish, Welsh and English, you see. The railway bosses set them up because their workers were always fighting with each other. Scots versus Irish and so on, and missing work. So this way, each nationality had their own place and they didn't get into so many scraps." "Gosh," said Hannah, "I didn't know that." "Well, I suppose you wouldn't, would you?" said Dolly, "but not in a nasty way." A tall man hurried past them and then must have turned back as a moment later he reappeared at Dolly's shoulder. "Will you come with me?" he said. "Not a chance," replied Dolly, and the man hastened away. Dolly didn't remark on the incident. Perhaps it was unworthy of comment. The two of them turned right into Angler's Lane past the False Teeth Factory, which was closed and quiet now, just a thin trail of smoke seeping from its chimney. "My pal works there," Dolly said. "I meet her from work and she comes out looking like a ghost, covered in this porcelain dust." She bent down to stroke a cat that had appeared at her ankles. "She said it's not that bad, though. They only employ women, so no creeps trying it on when the supervisor turns his back. She keeps on telling me to apply for a job." "Would you?" Dolly gave Hannah a look of disdain. 6 in the morning till 6 at night, 6 days a week. A week's holiday at the seaside, surrounded by all the same people you work with. Are you joking?" They had now arrived at the top of Hadley Street. 100 yards down sat a glowing inn, noisy even from here. And of course, now that she saw it, Dolly realised that she had been in the public house before. "Ah yes, the Trafalgar," she said. "It's all right, no rougher than the others." They walked past rows of houses, their windows so flimsy Hannah could clearly hear the clank of crockery and the whistle of kettles from within. The faint smells of fish, potatoes and cabbage seeped out. It must be just after the dinner hour. Peering over the half-nets, Hannah glimpsed front parlours just like Mrs. Piercy's. Cheap floral wallpaper, a couple of chairs, a piano, the odd framed print, an aspidistra. She glimpsed women, or their top halves at least. Women with pink faces and tired eyes and messy hair, carrying things in and out of the room. No Gwens or Ivies to help out here. Had these women been at home all day, or had they done 12 hours at the teeth factory before coming home, covered in porcelain dust, to shove a cod's head in the pot? She thought about asking Dolly, but didn't want to invite her disdain. She heard the sounds of children thumping mulishly at the piano, laughing, quarrelling with each other, but no male voices. Presumably, having eaten their dinners, the husbands had now all absconded to the Trafalgar. Outside the public house they stopped. The din was formidable, even from here. Ahead of her, Dolly pushed at the door, and a particularly loud burst of laughter seemed to intimidate even her. She hesitated for a moment, her hand flat on the wood, before stepping inside. The door banged shut behind her. Hannah stared at the panel of frosted glass, the dark shifting shapes within, and reminded herself that she had been in this position before, trepidatious outside a Walker's public house. But of course, at the Cock Tavern on Fleet Street, she had been accompanied by Cosmo, a man, her fiancé, and in that case, she hadn't thought that Frank Hogg might be inside.
Thank you so much, Lottie. It's been amazing to talk to you and to hear about Mrs. Piercy. Mrs. Piercy's available from Phoenix Books and it's out now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.